Well, good evening, everybody. I'm really delighted that we have Willem to give this Queen's Prize lecture. The prize was not actually awarded to Willem. It was awarded to the Centre for Economic Performance. But Willem is an ideal person to give the lecture because of his contributions in the past to the centre, but more because of his contributions to economics. As most of you probably know, he is one of Europe's leading macroeconomists with a special contributions in international macro. Like many successful people, he started as a lecturer at LSE in the economics department. He's since had chairs at Bristol, LSE, Yale and Cambridge. More recently he's been a member of the Monetary Policy Committee and he's now the chief economist at the EBRD and a visiting professor at LSE and associate of the Centre for Economic Performance. But Willem has never let his positions prevent him being extremely outspoken, and I'm sure he will be extremely outspoken tonight, which will be very interesting because I think he's chosen one of the most important and deeply worrying topics that could possibly be addressed, which is the topic of deflation. Willem.
Thank you. Thank you, Richard. It's a pleasure to be here. The lecture I'll be giving is based on a long paper of mine, which is available, I think, both on the Centre's website and on my own website for those of you who can't get enough of a, well, let's call it a good thing. The paper is long because I didn't have the time to write a short one. It's, let's see, it works. The topic of deflation has been out of fashion for almost half a century, I think, since people in the late 40s began to forget the events of the 30s and the 20s. And the first bullet point here is really gripped from one of Paul Krugman's papers on the liquidity trap in Japan. Suddenly, the deflation has come back as an issue that preoccupies the minds of central bankers, of ministers of finance, of the IMF, and of basically anybody engaged in macroeconomics. It's good to start with a definition, since I normally get the definitions right. Reasoning from the definition is much harder. But when I talk about deflation, I talk about a sustained decline in the general price level, in the cost of living index. And the precise definition matters greatly for many purposes. For the purpose of this talk, it doesn't matter at all. You can think in the UK of the RPI, the RPIX, the RPIY, or sort of Europe-wide, the HICCP index, the Harmonized Index of Consumer Prices, which the ECB doesn't quite target, but almost targets. And the GDP deflator, all these things will be good enough for the purpose that I have. I particularly want to point out that I'm not talking about asset price deflation. Major declines in asset prices, either across the board, stock market indices, housing, land, other real assets. It's an important phenomenon. There have been times that asset price deflation has been the proximate determinant of subsequent deflation in the sense that I will use it, but it is conceptually quite different and it should not be muddled up. Now, why worry about deflation? At the end of this lecture, I will actually come to the conclusion that provided the policy authorities in the known universe cooperate and act with the competence that we have a right to expect, mild deflation is nothing to worry about. But it's clear why people do worry about it. There is the historical association in the minds of people of deflation with financial crises, with depressions, with recessions, with unemployment, with the great deflation of the Great Depression of the 30s. as a second issue, sort of a more technical economist issue, that there is a big asymmetry in the monetary policy apparatus up and down. You can raise nominal interest rates to any level you see fit, and unless people implement my incredibly clever proposal, you can't get nominal interest rates below zero, because negative interest rates on non-monetary assets are not possible, because the zero nominal interest rate on cash, on currency, sets a floor under nominal interest rates. Now, so the liquidity trap, which is an extreme version of this can't lower the floor type argument, is a situation where monetary policy has lost all its capacity to stimulate demand, and it's clearly something to avoid and something to worry about if you can't. Notice, however, that in the far reaches of macroeconomic theory, deflation actually characterizes optimal monetary policy. It's a result due to Milton Friedman and Martin Bailey, who pointed out that since fiat money, paper money, costs nothing to produce, you should really satiate the economy with real money balances. To do that, you have to get the financial opportunity cost of holding money at zero. And that happens if it's a zero nominal interest rate. So and a zero nominal interest rate, in all likelihood, if the real interest rate is positive, requires deflation, so that the rate of deflation, the negative rate of inflation, is the same as the real interest rate, and the nominal interest rate is at zero. So this is something that we forget for the rest of the lecture, but it's kind of a cute point to make. The deflation in Chicago, at least in some parts of Chicago, is optimal. Now, why are we worried today? Well, it's clear that the recent economic history shows us why this particular genie has popped out of the bottle. In Japan, the Bank of Japan's discount rate has been at 50 basis points or less since 1995. It's now effectively at zero. Japan has been in a slump since 1992. Occasional signs of life are immediately sniffed out. The GDP deflator, broad index, has fallen in each of the past 5 years, and the rate of deflation appears to be increasing in magnitude. The CPI, the consumer price index, and money wages have fallen in 4 of the 5 last years, and again show signs of getting worse. So if an economy that's performing awfully, and part of this syndrome of stagnation, low investment, and in the Japanese case also major disarray in the financial sector, a need to restructure the banking sector and much of the rest of the financial system, and deflation, they come together. How about outside Japan? Okay, this is the picture. Can you see these things? No, let's forget about it. It just basically shows that they did indeed in Japan a situation where a massive asset deflation was followed by price deflation of the kind that worries people. The Japanese stock market, on the most common index, was at about 30,000 in late 89, and it's now at about the level of the Dow. 8,000 or 9,000 or thereabouts, haven't looked recently. So there's a massive stock market collapse, a massive collapse in a simultaneous boom of real asset prices, houses, land, golf club memberships, right? So financial collapse followed by this persistent stagnation, which the policy authorities seem to be unable to work. What about in Euroland? Well, the ECB's interest rate, the repo rate, is at 2.5%, so they still have 250 basis points left before they hit zero. Hiccup inflation is actually still above 2%, but probably trending down. That's the harmonized index. On the harmonized index, actually, UK inflation is about 1.6% now. It's below Euroland. The real economy is tanking, and the euro is its strongest since 4.5 years ago. So they're not in imminent deflation territory for euro area as a whole, but selected bits of Euroland, Germany in particular, are likely to experience mild deflation over the next year or so, looking forward. And, well, this thing can't be read, never mind. In the US, this situation is objectively closer to becoming worrying if you decide to worry about deflation, because the Fed only has 1.25% left on its interest rate. the federal funds rate. The real economy, in the words of Mr. Snow, is soggy. Right? It's not sort of flat the way Euroland is, but it is growing at a sort of disappointing rate, 1.5, something like that, annualized rate. CPI inflation, 1.9%. Underlying core inflation, stripping out some of the volatiles, 1.6%. The same holds for Mr. Greenspan's favorite inflation index, which is the personal consumption expenditures deflator, which also is about 1.9 and underlying 1.6%. So the US has, of course, like Europe, had a major asset market blowout following the bubble of the late 90s, and come out of a recession is at the moment trying to initiate a sluggish recovery with inflation at a historically low level. Okay, forget that. And in the UK, of course, you have the Bank of England, where, at least from an interest rate point of view, the kitty is fullest. Right? The Bank of England has 375 basis points left before they hit the floor, and hiccup inflation is actually quite low at 1.6%. The GDP deflator runs at 3.2%, big gap between these two, basically partly because the harmonized index that is used in Euroland excludes any attempt to allow for housing price inflation. The retail price index does, but in the wrong way, so it's neither of them is any good. But this is the country, I think, where of all advanced industrial countries, worries about deflation would seem to be least appropriate, sort of simply looking at recent behavior of real activity, which is slow but not stagnating, and inflation, which is higher and likely not to come down a lot, with sterling finally having taken the nosedive that they've been waiting for so many years. Okay, that's the UK, forget these pictures. I mean, history is no good unless you have at least 200 years of data. So I think that the most interesting perspective on whether inflation is something to worry about you obtain when you look at long historical periods over which prices have declined and see whether these were indeed typically characterized by real stagnation. You find that if you look at the retail price index in the UK since Napoleon, which is after 1812, you notice two things. First of all, the zigzag is the inflation rate, and the sort of even line is the price level. You find that inflation is both highly volatile and on average negative for the whole 19th century, for the period between 1814 and First World War, effectively. And while there were periods of recession in that period, in the second half of the 19th century, the gold standard period, there were also periods with sustained growth. You find, for instance, that while inflation on average in the 19th century was negative, that the bank rate never hit the zero floor. In fact, bank rate, which is the repo rate of the dinosaurs, was never less than 2% over the whole period. So there was no liquidity trap. There was no zero bound problem during the longest historical period of deflation. So that's a bit of hope. Now, whether or not inflation is something to worry about depends on the causes of deflation. Now, basically, you can differentiate good and bad deflations. Good deflations occur when positive supply surprises, say unexpected productivity growth, the new economy miracles, or a sustained decline in the price of some key intermediate imported input, oil or whatever for an oil importer, when a positive supply shock causes potential real output to grow faster than nominal aggregate demand. Okay. Such a deflation will be a high growth, high employment, high profit, and booming stock market deflation. We had some of that in the period 1870-1896 in the United Kingdom, where we had mild deflation accompanied by positive growth, and not just in the UK, but in most of the gold standard area at the time. Note, however, that growth did pick up during the period of higher inflation after 96, so it's not a convincing story, not a conclusive story. Now, bare deflations occur when the driving element is a negative demand shock, which causes nominal aggregate demand growth to fall below the growth rate of potential real output. Such deflations, and that's the deflations we're now seeing in Japan, and that we are seeing, I think, beginning to see in Germany, are characterized by stagnating output growth, rising unemployment, falling profits, and falling stock markets. And we have some spectacular examples, 1929, 1921, the post-World War I collapse, the Great Depression, and Japan since 95, and maybe looking forward, Germany. Now, so we know how to fight inflation, right? Governments and central banks the world over have got a lexicon. It's painful sometimes. No, you have to raise interest rates in the short run. They have to cut public spending, raise taxes, get the growth rate of the monetary aggregates down. It's painful, it's unpleasant. We know how to do it. Well, is either preventing deflation or getting rid of it once it takes hold simply these policies in reverse? In that case, there should be no unsolvable problem. There's nothing new under the sun. We simply, you know, change the sign on all our policies. Raise spending, cut taxes, you know, lower interest rates. Now, there are some ways clearly in which the cost of inflation, positive inflation, and deflation, or negative inflation, are not qualitatively different. The menu cost argument for inflation works whether inflation is positive or negative. As soon as prices aren't constant, you have these costs. That's very minor anyway, but I just mention it to show my credentials, my professional credentials here. Shoe leather costs, again, they are sort of a continuous, they are continuous in the opportunity cost of holding money. The higher the nominal interest rate, the rate of return differential between nominal assets, non-money assets, and monetary assets, the higher the interest rate, nominal interest rates, the lower the demand for real money balances. The more people will try to economize on holding money balances by doing inefficient forms of portfolio management, and this shoe leather cost goes down and down until the nominal interest rates hit zero, and there's nothing sort of asymmetric about it. Now, what are the asymmetries? In what sense is deflation, or doing something about it, different from simply doing an anti-inflationary policy with the sign reversed? I already referred to the lower bound on nominal interest rates. We cannot, in the present state of play, have negative, seriously negative nominal interest rates. And the reason's obvious. If you did, everybody would borrow at a negative nominal interest rate and invest in zero nominal interest rate cash, and you'd have a money machine. And the only theorem from finance that you have to know is that there are no money machines. That's all of finance. Second, of course, other asymmetries. Unanticipated inflation redistributes wealth and income from creditors to debtors that are not index-linked. Now, unanticipated deflation, of course, redistributes things the other way around. For nominal contracts, non-index-linked contracts, the redistribution is away from debtors and towards creditors. So the direction of the redistribution is not a matter of indifference, because redistributing from debtors to creditors is more likely to be associated with financial distress, bankruptcy, and default than redistribution is the other way around. But there is no sort of analogy when you redistribute from creditors to debtors to the default penalty that you pay when you distribute excessively from debtors to creditors. There's no such thing as super solvency penalty. Right? So there are some other asymmetries. People argue that there are asymmetries in the speed and the ease with which nominal prices and wages especially can be adjusted. That there is a downward rigidity that is greater than the upward rigidity in nominal costs. And finally, I think, although this is becoming less relevant, there's an asymmetry because my generation and sort of the generation that has no conscious memory of the Great Depression years has never experienced deflation to any serious extent. It's changing now in Japan, but the unfamiliarity of deflation makes it different from inflation in the way people respond to it. Now, why don't we see negative nominal interest rates? I already explained this. If you had negative nominal interest rates, I'd borrow at them and invest in cash, and I'd make infinite profits that way. So the floor on nominal interest rates is set by the zero nominal interest rate on the monetary base. The government's monetary base consists of two components: currency and bank reserves with the central bank. Now, there's no problem at all with paying negative interest rates on the commercial bank reserves with the central bank, with the Bank of England. Just as it would be completely trivial to pay negative interest rates on your bank account. Because your bank account and commercial bank reserves with the Bank of England are what I would call examples of registered securities. That means that the issuer knows the identity of the holder, the named account. And then it's very easy to pay either negative or positive interest rates. So if there was no cash, there would be no problem. There is cash, so there is a problem, because cash is anonymous. It's a bearer bond. You can present cash for payment without having to prove sort of who you are. Now, the problem this creates is that if you try to either pay positive interest on currency or to collect negative interest rate on the currency, you have a problem. There's a problem even with a positive rate of interest. How do you pay positive interest rate on cash? It doesn't have my name on it. So I could just, in principle, take my money to the if the bank paid central bank paid 5% nominal on my pound note, I could go there, collect it, and then come back the next day with the same note, and over and over and over again, because there's no way of marking this note as paid. And that's what you would have to do. In order to get around that problem, you have to mark the bank note effectively, stamp it, show that interest, has been paid out and therefore cannot be collected again. How about the other case, where there's negative interest, where I, as the holder of the central bank liability, have to pay them interest? Well, why should I go walk up to the central agency to pay my interest? Let them go find me. That would be the natural response. And this is the problem. You can only get around that if you somehow create an incentive for the anonymous holders of the bearer bond currency to come forward and pay the interest that they owe to the central bank. That can be done in principle. You could basically have an expiry date on the currency, which would mean that anybody who is caught holding the currency without a stamp on, after a certain day, could have it confiscated or some such penalty. Then it could be a feasible strategy to have negative interest on the currency. Such schemes sound harebrained, and they are, but they were proposed in the 20s and the 30s by Gesell and others. Irvin Fisher, probably the greatest American economist ever, was a proponent of this. But the administrative costs are too high, and we have for the time being simply take the zero floor on nominal interest rates as, if not a natural fact, an administrative fact. We could relax that constraint, but it would involve increasing intrusiveness of the government in people's pockets, not something that we favor. Now, what about asymmetric nominal price and wage rigidities? Notice that the argument about downward nominal rigidity, making deflation particularly costly, is a selective one. It doesn't apply in asset markets. Right? The prices drop like stones. It also appears to not apply anymore very seriously in the markets for goods and commodities. Because in the last few years, in 2002, CPI inflation in the UK was 1.9%, but goods inflation was actually negative. Physical goods, services was 4.6%. So goods inflation has for years now, on average even, been negative. So there are many commodities where routinely prices are marked down. So the last bastion of downward nominal rigidity, or rather asymmetric downward nominal rigidity, greater downward rigidity than upward rigidity, is the labor market. And unfortunately, there's no evidence. There is evidence, both micro and macro, of nominal rigidity, but there's no evidence of asymmetric nominal rigidity. Steve Nicol and Quintini, who I refer to here, had a very interesting set of panel data, having thousands, I think, of individual contracts, where they simply plotted the change, the percentage change, say, in the contract wage by size. So you had a few at 5%, or a lot more at 2%, very few at 10%, and some at 0, da, da, da. What you find is that you get quite nice-looking distribution, but there is a big spike. Well, big spike, a little spike, at 0. So there is more action, or rather, there's more inaction at 0 than there ought to be. Right? There's a disproportionate number of 0 money wage change contracts. There's an outlier there. And it's small, but statistically significant. So there are nominal rigidities. But of course, simply from observing that it's a spike at 0, doesn't tell you that this is reflects contract that should have been negative and ended up at 0. It could have been contract that should have been positive and ended up at 0. So in and of itself, there's no evidence of where these contracts otherwise have landed. So there is, I think, there's certainly evidence of nominal rigidity, but no evidence that it is uniquely serious in a downward direction. There are lots of arguments about downward nominal rigidity that make no sense. These are the arguments based on fairness, on equity, on people caring about relative wages. I believe in these arguments. I think they're terribly serious arguments. But clearly what people care about, what fairness is about relative real wages, relative real incomes, rather than relative nominal wages. So I accept the morale arguments against real wage cuts. I accept the morale argument about the arguments about solidarity and cohesion. But solidarity and cohesion are real phenomena. They should not be drenched in money illusion, except to the extent that it reflects informational problems, which you would expect when you come from a period of typically high inflation, decades of it, and you enter in a period where you have low inflation or even deflation. Experience and the frame that people have for forming real wage expectations is colored by the period of high inflation. Okay, let's see what we can do. Now that I've argued, therefore, that deflation, especially if it is anticipated, right, and modest, need not be a major problem. But if it's any problem at all, it's better to avoid it. And if it is any problem at all and we're in it, we should get out of it. Can we do so? Do the authorities have the tools? Or do they have to do something terribly fancy? Well, first, I have to disentangle monetary and fiscal policy. That's kind of an essentialist argument, and it doesn't really matter very much. Think of monetary policy really as what a central bank does, right? Whatever that is. And fiscal policy the rest. More precisely, I will look at four monetary instruments. The short nominal interest rate, the repo rate on non-monetary securities, the stock of base money, right, and or the nominal exchange rate. And of course, in a wide open, financially wide open economy like the UK, only two of these three can be chosen independently by the monetary authority. And there's one unconventional monetary instrument, which is the nominal interest rate on cash and currency, which I'll henceforth forget. But it is there in principle, should you wish to upset all the generation of central bankers. Now, monetary policy is a change in any of these instruments, which does not change the overall financial net worth of the government. So this portfolio changes in these instruments. Think of it as the short interest rate, that do not change the financial net worth of the government, that do not involve changes in deficits or surpluses. Anything that involves a deficit or surplus is fiscal policy by definition. Now, so here we have monetary policy. Fiscal policy is the rest. So any change in public spending or taxes, whether or not they alter the financial net worth of the state, now or in the future. Now, the question of how to avoid deflation or how to get out of it if you somehow landed yourself in it, is one of the oldest questions in macroeconomics. Every intermediate textbook has it. Right? Effectiveness of monetary and fiscal policy. Can they stimulate aggregate demand? And that's all that matters. All we have to worry about. Can we boost demand? We don't have to ask general equilibrium questions about how does a given change in nominal aggregate demand get reflected in price changes or real GDP changes. That's interesting, but if you're worried about deflation, either one will do nicely. Right? If prices go up, then we've got rid of deflation. If real output goes up, we're even happier. So all you really have to know is, can monetary and or fiscal policy, singly or together, boost aggregate demand? And so, okay, for your edification, I want to just consider how monetary fiscal policy affect the main components of demand. And actually, I'll be mainly talking about private consumption demand. Because A, it's 60% of GDP, and B, it's the one where the story is told most easily. I have something to say about private investment demand and how monetary and fiscal policy can affect it. I'll have very little to say about export demand, except to point out that devaluation may have something to do with it, if that's the instrument. But so I'm looking at the demand components, private consumption, private investment, government spending on domestic goods, and export demand. And I wish you would get rid of the exchange rate stories. So for the moment, think of the question as asking, can I stimulate demand at a given exchange rate? Whether the exchange rate then changes or not, is up for the general equilibrium theorists to determine. But we have done our work by simply pointing out we are no longer in a trap. Something gives, in this case, it might be the exchange rate. Now, how does monetary policy influence the largest component of aggregate demand, private consumption? Well, I think you can view the world as being divided into two kinds of people. Short people and tall people. Now, this is also true. This is Keynesian consumers who just spend their current disposable income. Right, that's it. They have no assets. That's me. And no debts. That's not me. And they're permanent income consumers who basically face an efficient set of financial markets who can, either because they have sufficient stock of financial assets or because they can borrow at reasonable terms, smooth consumption over the life cycle. So the permanent income consumers who can take the long view, and the Keynesian consumers who just take the short view. Okay. Now, and this is the only equation you'll see, but it's kind of helpful because aggregate consumption, which you're trying to target, has a share of the population, sigma here, of Keynesian consumers, and they consume their wages minus their tax, their after-tax wage income. So for monetary policy, you can forget these guys. Right? Monetary policy doesn't affect the current wage or current taxes, so they're out of here. If monetary policy works on consumption, it has to work through the Friedmanian, the permanent income, the lifestyle consumers, and their consumption simply is proportional. This is called the marginal propensity to spend out of wealth, where wealth is defined in the most comprehensive way, contains all financial wealth, stocks, shares, housing, inventories of goods, and it contains human capital, human wealth, the present value of current and future labor income. These are the far-sighted guys. And of course, it's only a share, one minus the share of the Keynesian guys, because the Keynesian guys have human capital, but of course they can't borrow against it. But that's, so I'm going to say, how does monetary policy, if it works, can't do anything here, it has to work either through the marginal propensity to spend, or through financial wealth, or through human capital. And good economic theory tells us that there are three channels, really, through, private investment depends on future discounted profits, blah, blah, blah. Here we are. This is more the monetary policy. Think now of the key monetary instruments for most central banks in the world. Right? Central banks either use the normal exchange rate as an instrument, or the short nominal interest rate. No central bank in the world actually uses the monetary base as the instrument. They could if they wanted to, but nobody does, and I think nobody ever has. So think for the moment, keep the exchange rate constant, think of a cut in short nominal interest rates. Well, it will affect investment with a bit of luck, because investment is the present discounted value of future profits. Holding the future profits constant, a lower discount rate increases their value. Tobin's Q shoots up, we get some action out of that. The other mechanisms, you know, the credit channel, the bank lending channel, which reflect different kinds of imperfections in financial markets, and which may sort of give a further oomph to an interest rate cut. Notice, however, that a cut just in the current short rate of interest, which in principle is only set for a month, right, would have an epsilon effect on investment through this valuation effect, through its impact on the discounted value of future profits. And on consumption, it works, you know, on the marginal propensity consumed, this constant mu, either through the substitution effect and through the income effect. And then it works on the value of human wealth and on the value of financial wealth, so what I call the valuation effects. So just as a cut in interest rates boosts Tobin's Q and boosts investment because it increases the present value of future profits, Tobin's Q is also in household wealth, the value of the stock market. So there'll be wealth revaluations, and indeed it may increase the present value of future labor income for those who can borrow against it. So there are some valuation effects and substitution effects. Now, what evidence we have shows that the income substitution effects of a change in interest rates roughly cancel each other out. So you're not going to get any effect on the marginal propensity to consume, really, from a cut in interest rates. So if there is any action, it is through the valuation effects on consumption. So the effect that the cut in interest rate discount rates increases the current present value of future streams of profits of after-tax wages. Now the problem is, of course, that these effects, these valuation effects, affect demand through the marginal propensity to consume. This is not the marginal propensity to consume out of current disposable income, that's sort of a big number, but it's the marginal propensity to consume out of wealth, which is a small number, something like 0.05. It has this sort of dimension generally, people assume, of a real interest rate or the real interest rate on an annuity. So it's a tiny number. So to get any action out of interest rates on consumption demand, you better leverage any current interest rate increase and hope that the current interest rate increase, because you have, say, a credible reputation for following through your actions, also cuts or raises the current interest rate cut lowers the expected path of future normal interest rates. Right? And so, and the same holds, of course, for investment. The effect of a current interest rate cut on investment is leveraged if a change in current interest rates lowers the whole profile of expected future interest rates. Well, devaluation can, of course, be used if you have a different monetary strategy. I think that, especially in the short run, it is highly doubtful that the Marshall Learner conditions are satisfied. And so I wouldn't expect a lot out of that immediately. Now, let's now assume that we're in Japan. The government, the central bank rather, has shot its conventional bolt. Short nominal interest rates are at zero. What can it do? Well, obviously, the world doesn't end when you have set the current nominal interest rate short rate at zero and have created expectations that all future rates will also be at zero. You could have open market purchases of other government assets, long-dated debt, index-linked debt. You could purchase foreign exchange reserves, sterilized or unsterilized. You could purchase foreign currency assets. It has been recommended. You could purchase private domestic securities or real assets, stocks, bonds, whatever, real estate, houses, commodities. Right? And you could do more sensible things like easing the eligibility requirements for the securities that are acceptable in repo operations as collateral, and you can expand the list of eligible counterparties. But this has been recommended a lot. So the government goes in the wholesale purchase business of assets. I think that there are serious moral hazards, adverse selection and governance problems if the central bank does more than simply monetize the entire public debt. Sure, there's no problem with, I think there's moral hazards and adverse selection problems of monetizing the entire public debt, long dated, short dated, real or nominal. But once you start delving around in the stock market, the question clearly arises, are we buying lemons at the price of oranges? And how can we prevent the re-socialization of the means of production, distribution, and exchange? This would be a form of socialism by the back door, which may be desirable to some, but I think it's been tried and not worked. So more can be done there, of course, even in Japan, because in Japan, interest rates on public debt are still between 1.5% and 2%, or sometimes even higher. So they are not out of ammo yet. One policy that will not work is announce an increase in the inflation target, or to introduce an inflation target. Once you're at the floor, across the board, if all current and future expected interest rates are zero, then the announcement of an inflation target isn't connected to anything. It is like shouting the name of the rose. It has no effect on economic activity. For an inflation target, introduction or the increase in it, to have any effect, the target has to be linked to an instrument. And by definition, if everything is at the floor, you can't do that. So you can introduce an inflation target or raise it if you're not yet at the floor everywhere and don't want to get in it. But once you're in it, it's too late. A negative nominal interest rate, I've talked about that. It's cute. I got a publication out of it, but I would not recommend it. Now, what about fiscal policies? Clearly, if you have Keynesian consumers, fiscal policies are working a treat. They just cut taxes, bam, people spend. So to say that this won't work, you have to argue that either there are no Keynesian consumers, or the consequence of financing the deficit would be unbearable. Of course, even with permanent income consumers, tax cuts, if you finance them by borrowing, and let's for the moment just talk about tax cuts financed by issuing debt. Right? If you don't have Keynesian consumers, and everybody looks forward as a permanent income consumer, tax cuts will still work because tax cuts, postponing taxes and borrowing to make up the difference, will shift the burden of taxes towards the young and away from the old, because the tax has to pay in the future, and it will shift the burden of taxes away from those currently alive to those not yet born. And both will raise aggregate demand. For this not to work, you have to believe with Robert Barrow that there is debt neutrality. Right? That postponing taxes does not cause people to spend more, they simply save the entire tax cut because they anticipate and internalize fully, say because they are operative intergenerational gift and request motives, the higher future taxes that will have to be paid to service the larger debt. So this regards an equivalence. No, tax cuts financed by borrowing don't work. What can we do then? Well, forget temporary increase in public spending and domestic output. If it's temporary, it always works, but it's not really what I'm after. The policy that always works, even if in a world in which there are no Keynesian consumers, so everybody is perfectly far-sighted, in which there's debt neutrality, the policy that always stimulates demand is Friedman's helicopter drop of money, which is the cute way of saying a tax cut or an increase in transfer payments financed by printing money. And it's obvious, right? Basically, when you substitute, when you cut taxes and print money, there is no increase in the present, there's a reduction in the present discounted value of future taxes for the consumer. There is no interest burden that will cause the consumer to hold back on spending and save the tax cut. Think of the following experiment. Eddie George sends every man, woman and child in the United Kingdom a cheque for £1,000 drawn on the Bank of England. That's it. Right? Here, the central bank acts as a fiscal agent. It can't really do that. Right? But would you spend at least some of it, question. If you say no, then say, okay, let's make it 10,000. Right? If you still save it all, I think you'd be insane, but I would make it 100,000. At some point, the consumer will cry uncle or aunt, as the case may be. And the reason is that this is a pure wealth and income effect. It doesn't rely on intercompany substitution, no cute things. It is a net increase at given current future prices in wealth. At some point, people will start spending. Now, you can't do this in the real world because the central bank is not a fiscal agent. So who would have to do it? Well, Gordon Brown would have to do it. Right? The Minister of Finance. He sends the tax cut, and then he borrows from the central bank. And so it gets monetized. So effectively, you do it with a joint action of the monetary and fiscal authorities. Now, in Euroland, you couldn't even do that, because direct financing of the government by the central bank is not permitted. However, what is permitted is that the government borrows in the open market, and then the central bank purchases securities in the open market, in the secondary market. Of course, that's completely equivalent to selling it directly to the government, but it satisfies the letter of the law. So it can be done. The helicopter drop can always be performed, provided the central bank and the government work together. Feldstein has a proposal, which I just mentioned, that's the exact opposite. The helicopter drop of money is sort of a pure income or wealth effect story. Feldstein has a pure substitution story. He wants a cut in VAT today, basically, and a sort of revenue neutral, in present value terms, increase in value-added taxes tomorrow. So that makes purchasing goods, especially durables, today cheaper than purchasing it tomorrow, and you shift your expenditure towards the present. It's cute, but started. I believe in the helicopter drop, and I want to be the one that lets the money go. Now, again, important to see how much of this could a central bank do on its own, of the unconventional policies. Certainly, the central bank can do some open market operations. But in many countries, the central bank is actually barred from buying all but a very limited class of private sector securities, the kind of purchase that had been proposed for Japan. In that case, of course, the Treasury again would have to do the purchases, with the central bank then refinancing the Treasury, with the Treasury selling ordinary government debt to the central bank. So again, for sort of exotic purchases of assets by the state from the private sector, I don't recommend them, but if you wanted to do them, you would in many cases need a joint effort by the central bank and the Treasury, the Ministry of Finance. And the helicopter drop I already described, that the central bank really can't do this. It's not an autonomous fiscal agent, so it requires the Treasury assistance, but with the Treasury it can be done. I'm almost on time. Conclusion. A moderate and anticipated inflation need not be a serious problem. Clearly, unanticipated deflation is always a problem, and it is more of a problem than unanticipated inflation, because it creates the risk of financial distress, bankruptcies. If you wish to avoid deflation, even anticipated, or if you have deflation and want to get out of it, the tools do exist. And one tool, the perfectly conventional, ultra long-bearded tool of having tax cuts or transfer payment increases financed by printing money, is foolproof. It works when interest rates are positive, when interest rates are zero. It would work when interest rates are negative. You're giving a pure wealth transfer to the private sector. There's no corresponding offset in the form of future taxes. So they will spend it. And depending on the economic configuration, either prices or real quantities will go up, or both. So deflation can be avoided. And if it has taken hold, deflation can be eradicated. And the amazing thing is that ending inflation, or deflation, or avoiding deflation, is a political godsend. It's what every politician wants to hear. You want to hear a deflationary threat as a politician, because you can increase spending, and you can cut taxes or increase the benefits, and you can go to the central bank and say, okay, boys, you can print now. It's all right. And this is, of course, exactly what politicians want to hear. Fighting inflation is hard, it's costly. Tax increases, spending cuts, higher interest rates. So it's a political no-brain as well as technically, I think, trivial. Okay, let's see, not quite there yet. There are a number of statements about inflation, deflation, but I'd like to run by you, because they're all true, but in an ascending extent. And I want to add my own deep thoughts to the list of deep thoughts I will give to you here. First is that inflation, and therefore also deflation, is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. This is due to Milton Friedman. This statement is true, but it's not deep. Remember, inflation is a change in the price of money. To say that the price of money is a monetary phenomenon is not surprising, as will be, I think, reinforced by the next quote from even more famous economist. Right? The price of bananas is always and everywhere a banana phenomenon. And so it is really, it's not a deep thought, but it's okay. The next statement gets close to where I want to get to, that Sargent and Wallace pointed out that yes, inflation is ultimately a monetary phenomenon, but money itself, through the need for the government to finance itself and limits on the ability to incur debt because of the government's solvency constraint, money itself is a fiscal phenomenon, but a deficit phenomenon. So therefore, inflation ultimately is a deficit phenomenon. So that's a deep thought. Well, moderately deep. The next statement is that excessive inflationary budget deficits are the reflection of unresolved social conflict. This is a statement attributed to Joachim Marx, who was Karl Marx's unsuccessful younger brother, who joined New Labour and was never heard of again. So it is clear that, you know, inflation, unwanted inflation, is the result of unresolved social conflict. But what about unwanted deflation? There's no conflict there. So unwanted, persistent deflation is always and everywhere evidence of unnecessary, avoidable macroeconomic mismanagement, including a failure to coordinate monetary fiscal policy. I think it is simply not believable that government, who throughout the ages, since the Caesars, have known how to make inflation, right? You spend and you debase the currency. It's really not that hard. Right? That they would have lost the knack now. Now, the last statement, I think, points out to a very specific problem that we have today. And that is, it is important that central bank independence should not be misinterpreted as not answering the phone when a chancellor calls. Right? The policy that's always successful, running an enhanced deficit and financing it by printing based money, requires a coordinated action of the monetary fiscal authorities. Across the world, they have created operationally independent central banks. And I believe that, on balance, that's a sensible thing. It's some subset of fiscal policy in the general sense, of which monetary policy is, of course, a part. Has been allocated to a separate committee because these instruments can be changed at high frequency and relatively little cost, so let them get on with it. But this independence should not undermine the capacity and the willingness to cooperate. And in too many places, not in this country, I think in the UK, one of the great strengths in the arrangement is that both the exchange of information and the general level of dialogue between the monetary and the fiscal authorities is high, and you need that. Without that, you can get into the Japanese situation. Japan has many problems, and the deep problems in the financial sector, the banking sector, are too complicated and too serious to handle in just 2 seconds flat. But it's also true that part of the problem is the inability of the central bank and the Ministry of Finance to agree on the monetization of deficits. The government doesn't cut taxes because they don't want to borrow anymore. Well, they shouldn't have to borrow, they should print money. And but they can't, the central bank can. In Euroland, we have a different problem. And there's, of course, that the logistics of engaging in a helicopter drop or in a money-financed tax cut or benefit increase, the logistics are much, much harder, because the central bank would have to coordinate with, at the moment, 12 fiscal authorities. So even for the same degree of willingness to cooperate, there is a greater coordination problem to handle. We'll have to qualify that, though. It is not clear what is more likely to fail. 12 national one-on-one coordination attempts or one monetary coordination with 12 fiscal authorities. Not completely. Don't compare one national coordination with 1 in 12. But there are real problems. We must not become the victims of the success of central bank independence. Independence does not mean non-coordination and non-cooperation. In fact, only independent agents can cooperate willingly and knowingly. And so the lessons of this lecture, if there are any, are really very conventional. That the oldest trick in the irresponsible government's book of tricks, run deficits, finance by printing money, will work in deflations as well as it works in inflations, and indeed in hyperinflations. We have the tools, and there is no excuse for unwanted persistent deflation. Thank you. We're happy to take questions. Comments.
Really, what is has been going on in Japan, I very, very...
Sorry, can you fix that? Please fix that.
Willem, sorry, Giles Keating.
Press the thing.
So the question is, in Japan, we are seeing large fiscal deficits combined with big increases in base money, and we're just seeing an appetite to hold more and more, for a continuing rise in the ratio of base money to nominal GDP. Doesn't this cast some doubt on your policy conclusion, point number one? Point number two, I just wondered if you gave insufficient airtime to the kind of... the financial sector problems that you mentioned the banks again briefly, and you touched on them in your asymmetry list, as well as things like the problems of that we've got in this country and in America and continental Europe of fixed rate insurance company promises and other nominal promises. I mean, you mentioned, but then you kind of didn't sort of treat that as a policy issue. Surely a major part of solving deflation is addressing through regulatory and other means those kind of nominal asymmetries that you touched on rather briefly.
On the first point, obviously you haven't done enough, right? They still have inflation. Just because people will choose to hold their entire wealth, for that reason, in base money, once they do that, I can still print more and send it to them. So at some point, at a given price level, the wealth will increase to the point that people are spending. So as long as there's any government debt outstanding, the job hasn't been pushed to the limit there. And as long as consumption isn't high enough to generate the pressure on aggregate demand, then not enough of a deficit, of a monetized deficit, has been run. It's just a... Yes, there have been unprecedentedly large deficits, we're really talking about unprecedentedly large problems. As regards to the second thing, the Japanese problems are sui generis. They have a financial sector reconstruction and deconstruction need that is almost unprecedented, I think, in modern history. There are also problems in the financial sectors elsewhere in the industrial world, as you would expect after, indicated the US, a 10-year uninterrupted boom. You would expect that masses of doubtful loans will have been made, that corporations and the banks have loans on the book to many enterprises that they wish they hadn't. And clearly, to the extent that real wealth has gotten destroyed there, and that this has not yet been recognized, no further painful adjustments have to be done. But there's no reason why this painful adjustment would have to be done with a falling price level. You can have the bank restructuring, you can have bank nationalization, you can have restructuring of life insurance companies or other with inflation, with hyperinflation if you want. You don't have to combine the structural problem of a very distorted and very unhealthy financial sector with the macroeconomic problem of falling prices. They can be uncoupled. We don't need the banks to get people to spend, you see. The notion that we can't do anything in Japan until we solve the banking problem first is based on the assumption that the only way we're going to get spending up in Japan is if we get the banks to lend again. That is just not true. Right? The government can act directly.
Tim.
Well, Willem, it's a brilliant lecture, and I want to make just one or two comments. The remark that inflation is a monetary phenomenon is not trivial, because, let me just put it, is inflation the result of too much monetary base or too much quantity of money? Or similarly, for deflation, is it because of too little base or too little money, meaning bank deposits? And in Japan, in the last 2 years, money has grown by about 3 or 4%, and banks' cash reserves gone up, they've trebled. Mm-hmm. So it is quite important to be clear what type of money one's talking about.
Base money, always, throughout my talk.
Exactly,
yeah.
And that's, I'm afraid, the problem. Because if you talked about money, I think it'd be rather more precise about what should be done. It isn't so much printing as it's open market operations conducted by the government to increase bank deposits. Okay, you shake your head. And that's the problem. I think it's partly because of your sort of background, you don't like to talk about money, meaning bank deposits. And that is the problem in Japan. I mean, the reason for the deflation is not lack of base, it's lack of money. And it is easy to deal with, but it's important to realize it isn't Bank of Japan's problem, it's the government's problem. And again, you made that point very well. The government has got to borrow from the banking system on a large scale and increase bank deposits, and that would work. To pick up the point just been made, the other difficulty in Japan at the moment is that because bank credit to the private sector is falling so rapidly, there needs to be a huge amount of borrowing by the government from the banking system. You're quite right, it's not difficult to do, but they must get the right intellectual answer, and that is the right answer. It's a matter of dealing with money, not the base. And the government has to do it, not the Bank of Japan.
Yeah. I sort of agree with the sign on your statements and totally disagree with the magnitude. I think the Japanese banking sector is still way too large, right? It has to shrink. So any policy by the government, which could certainly be part of a sensible policy, to buy up private securities in order to reliquify the economy, has to be based on the presumption that the banking sector has to shrink relative to GDP. Japan is overbanked, right? And so that one. And then also the point about getting spending out there to rise, especially consumer spending, is not contingent on this happening to the banking system. You could set up a new set of institutions write the existing lot off. It really is not logical. Whether or not inflation is a monetary phenomenon is a deep or a trivial statement. I always felt the statement the price of money is a monetary phenomenon to be rather unsurprising, like the banana statement. And it can be made more interesting by pointing out that most of the variation is on the supply of bananas, rather than on the demand of bananas. But it's still, I think, roughly at that level. And probably Friedman has been lunching out for too long on that particular statement.
My question is simple. What is, in your view, is the ideal inflationary rate?
Zero.
The what?
Zero.
Inflation rate?
Yeah. No, that's the true inflation rate. How you measure it, that's your problem. I just, it probably corresponds on the hiccup index to something like 1 or 1.5. If you're very worried about hitting the zero bound, I can put it up a bit. But I think the ECB's target or non-target of 2% on the harmonized index is probably it's probably reasonable. I prefer it slightly lower because I really find measuring with a different size yardstick every year a nuisance. But it's no big deal. Once you're in the range between between 0 and 5, it really doesn't matter that much.
Mm-hmm. Willem, I think some people here want to know why you gave that monosyllabic answer, because you dismissed shoe leather arguments and all kinds of arguments which would lead to zero. No, why are you giving the answer zero?
It is shoe leather arguments. That's the it's the easiest thing to work with mentally. It's the menu cost argument. That works for mental menu costs.
Well, I mean, even taking...
In the UK, there may be some countries...
If you take the Europe, I mean, this means deflation, as you defined it, in half the countries of Europe.
Yes, certainly. I'm not that worried about it. I think that the fear of deflation, which should really be the fear of unanticipated deflation, is largely based on an economy that has gone through 50, 60 years of high, sometimes runaway inflation. And so and that, of course, will be an economy in which there's downward nominal rigidity, because nobody who wants to avoid a real cut will grant a nominal cut, because that's, in an informationally troubled environment, when the underlying inflation rate is positive, a sure way of getting yourself a real floor not below zero is to insist on nominal rate below zero. I think that's where the asymmetric downward nominal rigidity comes from. Now that we see increasingly negative price changes for commodities, both at the retail, the wholesale, indeed at the enterprise levels, I think we are much more likely to return to a situation like that we saw in the 19th century, where even money wages can go up as well as down. I think fundamentally people care about real magnitudes. This I learned from my mother. She's a ferocious shopper, and she sure as hell didn't know the difference between normal and real. And I think I'm happy to accommodate the concerns of those who say there really is something magical about zero, by saying, okay, let's shoot for 2%, because that. If I had the true cost of living index, I'd want it to be constant, simply for mental arithmetic reasons. For menu cost reasons.
Yes.
I have to come back to what other speakers already said. I agree with you that it would be easy if we live in a Friedmanite world, that is, where a helicopter substitutes for the banking system and where downwardly rigid nominal wages are only a cost problem. But if we live in a world where we have markup pricing and where the price of money is not the reciprocal of the price level but the interest rate, I suppose it's a bit more difficult. If you then throw money at consumers via the Gordon Brown's check, what happens if these consumers being confronted with the fear of unemployment, falling nominal wages, because that's the real spiral downwards. So not downwardly nominal rigid wages would be actually the one thing that breaks the deflationary spiral. But if that is not guaranteed, for example, because we have welfare state reforms like workfare that may people or liberalizations in the deregulation in labor markets that may allow for downwardly flexible wages, and people then take the check of Gordon Brown and bring it to the banking sector, deposit. But these banks, instead of giving credit to firms, would, for example, pay back debt with the central bank that they had incurred at a higher interest rate earlier, or would simply build up their cash reserves with the central bank, then they neutralize this check.
It only would be a problem if nobody actually ended up spending any part of this tax cut or transfer increase.
But and it if may that is be the too slow before the banking system does not collapse.
If that is the case, just send a larger check. Right? I mean, that is really how it works. And then something funny tends to happen. Because then people say, no, this will be inflationary. And I say, yes, that's exactly what you want. Right? Exactly. So the banking system point, if the banks refuse to lend any of it out, if they insisted on going to 100% Henry Simonsian banking system, I'd be happy also. It still can work that way. So it would be nice if we had a healthy banking system that didn't just on land, but actually on land to credit-worthy counterparties, right? It would be a nice change. But it is not necessary for the avoidance of deflation.
My question is, do you think deflation risk is a problem for Germany? And if so, what would be your advice for the government? Because they can't tell the European Central Bank to print money for them. And if they increase spending, they have a problem with the stability and growth pact.
Well, I think that it seems likely now, this is not, I'm not expert on this, but the latest forecast I've seen is that Germany is likely on the, say, the harmonized index to have experienced mild deflation over the coming year or so. Well, that in itself is not something I worry about, because A, it's mild, and B, it's fully anticipated. Right, and admittedly, if it there are contracts that have nominal contracts that were signed before this deflation was anticipated, so there'll still be some unpleasant surprises there. But I think it will be relatively minor. I don't expect we'll see a sort of Fisherian debt deflation of the kind that destroys otherwise viable economic entities simply because there's an anticipated increase in a mismatched asset liability structure. But what they can do is, what they can do in Germany is very little. They have, of course, no independent monetary policy, so that half of it can only be done in agreement with the European Central Bank, and they have very little room on the budgetary side because they have already exceeded the limits of the Stability and Growth Pact, and because in the absence of monetary financing, which they no longer can do at their discretion, they could only finance deficits by borrowing, and of course German interest rates are by no means zero. Even at the very short end. So there are real problems. So Germany has, because they have no independent central bank, no fiscal elbow room, they have no conventional demand management tools left. So all they have left is the structural sort of supply side reform measures that would boost presumably mainly business demand, but possibly also household consumption demand in a way that is roughly deficit neutral. And a lot can be done there. But to get serious structural reform, including labor market reform, through the German political system is like an elephant giving birth. It's a very long, drawn-out process.
No problem. I wondered why you spent so much time dwelling on mechanisms to make consumers spend more. Why not just use an old-fashioned Keynesian remedy or have government do it? And second, until the last sentence, you barely mentioned the supply side. Does the supply side have any role in the solution to deflation that you've been talking about?
Logically, if you read my immensely long paper, which has indeed covered all these things, it's clear that government spending on goods and services, again, financed through monetary issuance, is equivalent to tax credit and transfer payment increases. So you could have government exhaustive spending increase as well. I already talked about benefits, so the transfer side of government was I did talk about. Yes, but you can do this by, especially if deflation ever to become a problem in Britain, which I do not anticipate, but then with the enormous backlog of infrastructure investment, there are lots of nice things that you could drag out of the box. The supply side, it's not central to it. I believe that there are certain supply side reforms which would also stimulate demand. Right, and that's basically what I recommended for Germany. If you find ways of, say, changing the structure of taxation or business regulation, the burden of non-wage labor costs, then you might actually get some action through corporate spending as well as possibly household spending. But I think these things do, unfortunately, take a lot of time. The kind of measures I'm talking about, at least in principle, should take very little time. Although, again, I may be slightly biased here through the British example. Britain is the only country in the world where taxes can be, and transfer payment benefits can be changed sort of overnight. A single vote, bang, there it is. In other countries, getting any kind of fiscal measures through is very time-consuming and sometimes almost impossible. I mean, look at a situation in the United States where a large tax cut is sort of winding its way through the congressional structure. The Senate has a $350 billion cut coming, but the House has $550. And the White House wants something different altogether. So this is it's very, very difficult. So fiscal policy in the States isn't made. It happens, right? In a sort of very organized spontaneity way. In Europe, of course, it's even harder because there we have the 12 fiscal authorities. And in Japan, I think the relations between the fiscal and the monetary authorities are worse than in any other industrial country, which makes that difficult. So even actually the pure fiscal demand side measures are not institutionally trivial, even though technically they are trivial, and politically they should be attractive from an electoral point of view. But if you can use measures, fiscal measures, but also help the supply side, by all means do so. But it's not a necessary part of the story.
I think we're going to have to stop it there, but we could obviously go on a very long time. This has been a wonderfully stimulating and wonderfully lucid lecture, which I know you've all enjoyed. And I very much hope at least the Japanese will listen to you and even provide you with a helicopter. I hope there won't be too many other countries that need to listen to you. Maybe there will. I think this is not an issue which is going to go away quickly, and we've been very lucky to have this really, really clarifying lecture. Thank you very, very much, Willem.
Thank you.